Hi, I'm Sam Canduff, and this is Decoding Cultural Leadership. Welcome to Decoding Cultural Leadership. Culture, Society, Conversations, presented in association with Limelight. It's great to have you with us. If you're listening for the first time, thank you for finding us. If you're returning, welcome back. In this series of unfiltered conversations, we explore the intersection between culture and society and explore the meaning of the shifting expectations of leadership, cultural leadership, in the 21st century. In each episode, we talk to some of the most influential organizational leaders, creators, policymakers, and thought leaders. And we explore their approach to shifting the dial in a complex, constantly changing world. We hope that you enjoy listening to this podcast as much as we enjoyed making it. We've learned a lot through these fascinating conversations, and there's so much more to come. So let's dive into today's episode, and together, let's decode cultural leadership. My guest today is Paul Grabowski.
This complete integration into the fabric of society, the more that we can help to make those things possible, to bring everybody into the sense that there is a creative person within, and all that needs is for the leadership to allow for that energy to be tapped into, we can release our better selves.
I was so thrilled to talk to Paul. He's one of Australia's most distinguished artists, a pianist, a composer, arranger, conductor. He's been artistic director of some of our major festivals and a very influential voice in some of our cultural institutions.
I think that art that sets out to be political self-consciously tends not to be very good art.
Paul became a household name as the musical director of Tonight Live with Steve Vizard. That's where I first became aware of him as an inspiring young jazz pianist. I saw him on television and thought, I really want to do that.
And all of a sudden I went from relative obscurity, you know, as a kind of up and coming jazz musician on what is essentially quite a small national jazz scene, to being a kind of household name for a while, you know, the Count. Here he is, you know.
He went on to become commissioning editor Ice Entertainment for ABC Television and had artistic director roles at the Queensland Music Festival, also the Adelaide Festival of Arts. He's written in multiple genres. He's worked with numerous artists. As the founder of the groundbreaking and influential Australian Art Orchestra, he created several highly commended projects and collaborations, notably Ringing the Bell Backwards. He talks about that and the gestation of that really famous work in our interview today. He also talks about Ruby, which was a really important project that he created with Archie Roach as part of their long-standing working relationship. Speaking of collaborations, Paul has recorded some stunning vocal piano duos where he's accompanied artists like Vince Jones, Kate Soprano, most recently Paul Kelly. He talked to me about all these various roles and his approach to leadership, his approach to working and being in the arts, the perspectives that he's brought to these roles as both an artist, a leader, and also as an administrator. He also talked really interestingly, I thought, about how the principles of jazz have guided his approach to leadership. And he shared also his views on the intersection of art, politics, and social change. So please enjoy this great conversation with Paul Grabowski. Something that always struck me about your work is that you're a virtuosically gifted musician, but you've contributed in so many other facets of cultural life as a leader. So can you just sort of talk a little bit about how your leadership roles have come out of your starting off as a musician? How have you sort of stepped into a more of a leadership role?
Well, it hasn't been something that I have planned in advance. It seems to have grown quite organically out of other things that I've been doing. I guess, look, it starts with everything I used to say came from my experiences playing jazz music for a start. And I think what jazz taught me right from the get-go is the importance of collaborating with people. You know, you can't really play that sort of music without being fully aware of its collaborative nature and the role playing that takes place and the responsibilities which take place in that situation. And I've had over the course of my life to think about how to explain that, particularly to people who really don't understand what is involved in it. And I've even had recourse from time to time to speak to, you know, corporate people, sort of talk to boards and even about what improvisation is about and what to look for in it and how to apply the principles of it to leadership in the corporate sector. So out of those thoughts that I've accrued over the years. I think of the experience of the improviser as having three salient qualities. The first one is that in order to be an effective improviser, you've got to have great technical command of your instrument. You don't want to be occluded by not being able to carry out what your intentions are, simply because you don't possess the technical finesse to do it. That's a very lose-lose situation, and that's why good musicians have to practice, because they're always seeking to go beyond what they can do. And that's not something to shy away from. I think that seeking to acquire that is both necessary and, I think, character building too. Then the second thing, which might sound like an obvious one, but it's really not so obvious, is the ability to listen. In order to be a good improvising musician, you have to be able to listen. And listening is necessarily, well, it's applied hearing, but it's necessarily something in which you have to put your own ego to one side in order to be able to take on board everything that's going on around you and sublimate yourself into that. So you've got to imagine that you are part of something greater than you, or something of which you are necessarily a part, not the main event. It's not as if you lead and everybody else follows. In improvised music, I don't believe that that is really what's happening. It's a shared conversation, usually. And in order to be an effective participant in it, you have to shut out your need to dominate it and just accept that you're a part of it. And that's much more difficult than it sounds. So that takes considerable understanding. Even, dare I say, maturity to really understand it. And then the third thing, which is kind of a corollary of that, really, is trust. To be a good improvising musician, and this is more from the point of view of what you are collectively seeking to achieve, you have to trust each other, because you're only as good as the people that you're with. And if they're not in support of you, then you're kind of being hung out to dry, or you're being forced by circumstances to have to dominate in some kind of a way. But whatever the outcome, it's bound to be less than the sum of its parts, because this idea of trust is very important in improvised music. So that those three principles, which I didn't kind of come up with this formulation in the 1980s, when it was the beginning of, you know, I guess my transition into the various things that we'll be talking about today. But it certainly was, I guess I had opportunities to apply my collaborative skills quite early on when I started to write film music. And, you know, you have to be a good collaborator. You have, in film music, you are really part of a kind of an ecosystem in which you are not the dominant kind of life form. You are a bit down the food chain. Sometimes it hopelessly so, you know, it really depends. There are different kinds of experiences which you can have in that world. That led me into television through, you know, my very long-standing friendship with Steve Vizard, really. And that gave me then national prominence, you know, for a while. I did that Tonight Show, five shows a week for 3 years. And all of a sudden I went from relative obscurity, you know, as a kind of up-and-coming jazz musician on what is essentially quite a small national jazz scene, but very, very little known outside of that, apart from the bit of work I'd done in film, to, you know, being a kind of household name for a while, you know, the Count, here he is, you know. So that then meant that I guess people started to understand that I wasn't just one thing. I could, that I had the capacity to do more than one thing. And I was talking to a producer at the ABC about an idea that I started to develop, doing a show, a series of programs about music, where I would be one of a team of, well, it was two of us, as it turned out, Jaslyn Hall being the other one. But we would select different themes to discuss. And then over time, a series of interviews were put together, which saw us traveling around the world, talking to all kinds of people. And often, as part of it, I would perform with them. And during that period, I got to know, you know, the head of television at the ABC at the time, who was Penny Chapman, and they were looking for, you know, a successor to the great Michael Shrimpton, who had been for many, many years at the ABC, the commissioning editor for ABC television for arts and entertainment. It was a huge portfolio. So he oversaw all the arts programming, but also things like Countdown and comedy and everything. Anyway, they split that role after he retired into two, which was one was Arts and Ent, which I took, and the other one was comedy. So that's how that happened. Then, and I guess, you know, that was a very much an executive leadership position within the ABC. And that's where I got my first taste of what it was like to work, you know, in a bureaucracy, which was part of the national remit about the arts and a place that it had, you know, in the kind of context of the national broadcaster. And that was a very, very steep learning curve for me.
Mm. And that was that time, wasn't it? 95, I think, wasn't it, when you took on that? And I remember that show very, very well.
The show was made in 95.
Yeah.
Went to air, I think, in 96. And I took on the role in 96 to 98.
Yes. Yes, that's right. Yeah. Yeah. And I remember you talking to people like Tony Bennett and traveling the world, as you said, meeting these, you know, sort of iconic figures in the music scene and playing with them and interviewing them.
Unfortunately, I didn't have the good fortune to talk to Tony Bennett. I would have loved to, but I did get to talk to, you know, like John Lee Hooker and Karlheinz Stockhausen and, you know, Wynton Marsalis. And I mean, a lot of very interesting people. Very, it was fascinating. It was a very eye-opening, the whole thing.
Yeah. It's really interesting how you set up the principles of jazz and the language of jazz, and particularly and something that's always interesting to me, and I think you sort of covered in your first point about jazz, is that you do need that technical capacity to be able to be a good jazz musician. You need to be able to have really good chops, and there's the element often of competitiveness and having to sort of, particularly when you're a young musician.
Yeah.
But what you said about checking your ego and in order to collaborate, and that I can imagine that's now as a jazz educator, as you have been for a long time, for young musicians who obviously, you know, get into the con because they're so great and they have all this wonderful technical capacity, getting them temper that or moderate it with those other skills.
It's interesting. I mean, my view about jazz has changed a lot over the years. I started out very much wanting to, you know, learn the tradition of the music. And I fell into a group of people in Melbourne in the 70s who had been students of or had been associated with students of Lenny Tristano, which was a very unusual thing at that time. But, you know, that was a particular view about jazz, of quite a purist view.
Hmm.
You could almost call it a classicizing view about what jazz was, which understood it in terms of, you know, a methodology and a canon with certain key figures in it. The interesting thing about the Tristano School is that ultimately what it leads to is complete freedom. So whilst the kind of the pedagogical paradigm would seem to be very strict, you know, you must learn to sing a Les de Young solo and then play a Les de Young solo, and, you know, the great jazz musicians are Louis Armstrong, Roy Aldridge, you know, Billie Holiday, Charlie Parker, Bud Powell, and so on, Les de Young, of course. But, you know, very kind of restricted. But, and yet these are the first school of music which ever recorded free jazz was the school around Lenny Tristano. So, and that was Lenny and Lee Konitz, Warren Marsh, et cetera, you know. So it's sort of, it's paradoxical.
Decoding Cultural Leadership is supported by Limelight, and the April 2024 issue of Limelight is now available online and in print. And as ever, it's packed with news, features and reviews. This month's issue features Lee Sales and Annabelle Crabb on their collaboration with the Australian Chamber Orchestra, Steve Reich at 87, and an exploration of the representation of disability on Australian stages. Limelight, Australia's dedicated music, arts and culture platform. Head over to the website limelight-arts.com.au and find out how you can start accessing Limelight's excellent content today.
But then that's what I've sort of learned about jazz over the years. Jazz is full of paradoxes. And where I landed eventually was that the person who summed up all of the paradoxes and the possibilities of jazz with his own extremely idiosyncratic way of putting it together was Ornette Coleman, you know, and Ornette Coleman ended up being one of my polar sort of aspirations about jazz music. And the other one was Miles, essentially Miles Davis. And, but you know, what it did was it ended up placing me, I would say, where I've arrived and where I'm quite comfortable now is in my own practice. I have a position about the music, which is very different from what I would describe as the orthodoxy represented by somebody like Wynton Marsalis, who I recently met up with again and interviewed just a few weeks ago in Brisbane. And I mean, you've got to love the guy. I mean, he's really quite extraordinary, and he is a genuine bona fide jazz intellectual, as well as being, you know, a kind of major public figure, world figure representing the music, but it's from a particular perspective, and it's a perspective which I can't even pretend to adhere to because I'm not that thing. You know, I grew up in the suburbs of Melbourne, Australia, and my kind of my circuit towards a jazz language has taken me to very, very different places, applying those principles which I talked about. But where I am now is somewhere where I probably wouldn't have imagined I would be when I was starting out playing the music.
Isn't that fascinating? The journey that you go on. Yeah.
Yeah, it really is. You know, yeah. I mean, I remember when I bought my first Ornette Coleman album, I bought The Shape of Jazz to Come, was it? Or I think it was that. And I bought the same day I bought Giant Steps. So I was about sort of 18 or 17 or 18. And, you know, I put them both on, and Giant Steps I could understand. I mean, it was like dazzling, but I got it. You know, it was changes and people playing incredible music across chord changes. Right. Check. Tick. I got it. Ornette's music, I kind of went, what even is that? That it seemed to fly so in the face of everything that I thought I knew about the music. And yet it became, over time, for me, the gold standard of what the music is ultimately all about. And beyond music, it's a kind of a philosophical position about just about anything, which is now what I call relationality. That music is built on relationality. And that's another principle out from the three that I mentioned, but it's another kind of driving principle in everything that I do.
That's fascinating. And Ornette, I mean, just again, one of those figures in jazz music where you just absolutely broke all the rules. And then at one point, put the sax down and picked up the violin and was just sort of, you know, phenomenally was not sort of constrained. It's interesting you mentioned
violin playing. I mean, you know, completely again, as any kind of school trained violinist would look at it and go, what the, you know, supposed to play the violin like that.
I think Miles could never kind of figure out Ornette Coleman, what he was doing, and didn't approve of a lot of things either, but, you know.
Well, and yet, you know, I would maintain that it ended up having an enormous influence on Miles. You know, I couldn't quite come to ever admitting it, but it's difficult to understand Miles's music post-1969 without some kind of reference to Ornette Coleman.
It's interesting you mentioned Wynton Marsalis, and I'm very much hoping to have Wynton on this podcast as well too. And absolutely, like where you talk about Wynton as a kind of a, he's almost a defender of the art form. You know, I looked at, I mean, and I went to his recent concert here in Melbourne and All Rise, and I talked to Ben Northey a couple of weeks ago about what a fantastic performance that was and life-changing for me in a lot of ways. But he's, you see, Wynton's almost always kind of defending the classicism of jazz, the swing, the structures, the standards and that kind of thing. That's sort of his role as an ambassador and with jazz at Lincoln Center. But when you started the Australian Art Orchestra, I'm sure there were probably comparisons between that orchestra and what you were doing there and jazz at Lincoln Center, but you were doing a very different thing with the Australian Art Orchestra, weren't you?
Yeah, very different. And again, this is, you know, something which I think is, you know, paradigmatic of the difference between the way that he would see things and the way that I would see things is that he is an African American and the standard bearer for an art form, which was I think, without any great cause for dispute, created by African-American people, and in its history has been represented in its sort of groundbreaking form or forms largely by African-American people. They have, you know, it's the great sort of art form which only African-American people could possibly have invented. And, of course, there are many, many different influences which go into the pot. But it's arisen out of the experience the African diaspora had, both as slaves and, you know, subsequently, and it explores every kind of facet of that, which, you know, is in its very nature one of the most formative and explosive contributions to 20th century culture in general, you know, regardless of what you're talking about. I think you can't talk about the 20th century without mentioning jazz. You know, it's got everything. It's got eloquence. It's got virtuosity. It's got improvisation. You know, it lives and burns in the moment. And what better way of describing what the 20th century is about than that? Now, where he and I would probably part ways is that I do regard that jazz as a 20th century art form, not necessarily a 21st century art form. And I think that jazz, and I've said this often, you've probably heard me say it, I think of jazz not so much as a noun, but more as an adverb. That it's a way of doing things, but not necessarily a thing. Now, he, I think, would absolutely disagree with that. So jazz is a thing, and you're only saying what you're saying because it's a thing. And it's easy for you to kind of, you know, try and get off the hook, but that's where we would have to agree to disagree. Because I have applied the word jazz to many different kinds of things that I've done, or the process of jazz to many different things that I've done without actually calling it jazz at the end of the day. I work with First Nations Australians. I wouldn't call it necessarily jazz, but there's certainly a jazz methodology which kind of informs it and brings it into being.
Yeah, yeah.
This is where the relationality idea is far more, I use that far more to describe what the outcomes, that they are expressions of relationality. And I would even hesitate, you know, I would suggest almost with great confidence, I think, that a lot of it would fall into the harmolodic scheme of things, more than Metz's kind of idea, which is a very difficult one to pin down, but I do in my mind say that harmolodics and relationality definitely kind of have a mutually kind of defining quality to them.
So taking this, as you say, these developed principles of relationality and these principles of improvisation and collaboration, you establish the Australian Art Orchestra as this kind of wonderfully diverse, musically diverse, stylistically diverse, highly collaborative unit. What was your inspiration for starting this ensemble, Paul, and what were you hoping to achieve with it? And it's still going today, you know, very strongly, obviously, as well, too.
Yeah, it is, which is great. Well, when I was living in Europe in the 1980s, one of the most interesting up-and-coming ensembles was the Vienna Art Orchestra, led by the Swiss pianist and composer. Well, he's mainly a composer, really, because I don't think he played piano on the band. Matthias Ruegg was his name, or is his name. And quite a few of the guys that I played with played in that orchestra. And they did really incredible things. And he found an amazing way to kind of fuse classical contemporary music with jazz and, you know, put it together in a really kind of extraordinary way, I thought. And then after I left Germany, I'd still maintain very strong links to the place. And a guy a trombonist in Munich where I had lived, a guy called Leo Gmelk. He commissioned me and a couple of other people to write music based on the one hand, but there were two projects. One of them was songs that Edith Piaf had sung, and the other one was songs associated with the UFA film studio, which made movies in Germany from the 20s right through the Nazi period.
Mm.
And he wanted us to explore this material and come up with, you know, new music for a contemporary jazz outfit of about 13, 14 players based on this, on these kinds of concepts. So, I set to work and, I ended up with, quite a few pieces, and they formed then the basis of the project called Ringing the Bell Backwards. And I thought, well, I've got all this music and it's never going to be played again. There was no way that, you know, this group that Leo had formed, it wasn't going to do anything after we recorded the arrangements or the pieces, but there were no plans to kind of keep it going. But I thought, well, there's no way I've written this music and it's just going to sit on the shelf. I've got to do something with it. And meanwhile, I had in my travels, I'd been starting to get a sense of who was around the place, just, you know, not just in Melbourne, but in Australia. And this is another thing actually I should go back and refer to. When I did decide to come back to Australia, one of the really important meetings and resultant conversations I'd had in Munich before I left was with Dale Barlow, the saxophonist from Sydney.
Mm.
And Dale had been living between Sydney and New York the previous years and had, you know, toured and recorded with Art Blakey and so on, and, you know, a really extraordinary player, heavy, you know.
Mm. Mm.
And he also was thinking about moving back to Australia. And we said, well, you know, I'm going to be moving back to Melbourne. You're going to be moving back to Sydney. Why don't we try and really attack this Sydney-Melbourne divide, which had been such a fact in Australian jazz music up until that point, that the pendulum tended to swing between those two places.
Mm.
But really the two scenes had pretty little to do with each other, you know, on the balance. And we decided that we would co-lead a band from both, you know, representing in a way both places. And that went really well. We ended up with a record contract with a major label, being Polygram.
Mm-hmm.
And then in 1988, the Australian Jazz Orchestra was founded, which was a bicentennial project, which had almost equal numbers of players from both places.
Mm.
One of the musical directors of that. And so when I started to think about putting together the AAO, by that stage, you know, I knew quite a few great players from Sydney and Brisbane, because I'd met, you know, John Rogers and Elliot Dalgleish and Ken Eady, the Artisans Workshop guys. And they were amazing. I mean, nothing mentally prepared me for that was even a thing. But, you know, you don't often cross the paths of a John Rogers in your lifetime.
Mm.
That was really, oh, my God, you know, there's a person that good in the world.
Incredible player, yeah, yeah. And Elliot too. I was at the conservatorium with Elliot. Incredible player.
Wonderful. Yeah, yeah. Incredible.
Mm.
Very different gestalt from John.
Yes.
So anyway, I mean, to make a long story even longer, I took this idea to Richard Werrett, was the director of the Melbourne Festival of Arts, 1993. Yes. And I said, I've got this concept, and I had the recordings that I'd made in Munich. I said, this is what we're going to do. Meanwhile, another friend of mine, it was Anna Schwartz, actually, the gal, told her about this. I said, I've got these French songs, I've got these German songs. And she said, so, you know, where's the Yiddish? You can't just be telling those stories.
Yeah.
So I then set about finding a couple of apposite Yiddish wartime resistance songs.
Yeah.
And rounded it off, of course, with We'll Meet Again from, you know, Vera Lynn.
Yes.
And that became Ringing the Bell Backwards, which, you know, is a kind of a, it's a meta critical look at the role of popular music within a historical context delivered via the kind of language of contemporary jazz and improvised music. So there's a lot of bits to it. But if you listen to that album, it's there. There's a lot of layers to it. And I still listen to it and think, you know, that was pretty ahead of its time, actually.
Yeah.
Because it involved sampling very early and combining sampling into a large ensemble context. And, you know, the band were young. Those players were like barely in their 20s. People like Adrian Sheriff, Stephen Grant, Philip Rex. You know, they were children, really. Simon Kent, you know, amazing young talent.
Yes.
And they were playing this really, really difficult music. It was hard.
Yeah.
So that was the beginning of that. And then, you know, after that experience, rather than it becoming my band, so this is where it verged from the Vienna Art Orchestra concert, because Matthias wrote all the music for the VAO. For me, it was going to be, you know, making it an opportunity for everybody to write music for it. And then it became very much a project-based ensemble.
Mm.
So after our legendary first tour, which you could write a book about, then we sort of set about going, okay, what interesting projects can we do? And things started to just fall in our lap weirdly, like the Foreign Affairs Department sent us to India.
Mm.
Because Adrian Sheriff, among the 20,000 instruments that he plays, had studied the Mridangam, of all things, with Ravi Ravichandran here in Melbourne, who was a disciple of Guru Karakudimani, the late great Karakudimani. We ended up touring India with Karakudimani, a legend.
Incredible.
In Carnatic music. I mean, it was like touring with Ravi Shankar or something.
Yeah.
And for us, it was like, God, how is this even possible that he's agreed to come on the road with this ragtag band, which at that stage also included people like Mark Simmons, you know, and really kind of heavy characters as well, the heavy musicians. And, you know, that led to the Into the Fire project, which had quite a long life. And then we did the one called Passion, which is based on the St. Matthew Passion of Bach, which I also think is a really beautiful piece of work. And then the next major project we did was with Archie, with Uncle Archie.
Ruby.
And Auntie Ruby, yeah.
Mm.
And that then sent me on the beginning of a whole new chapter in my life.
Mm.
So round about that time, I also had my first trip to Nooka and met the Wolfords, the young Wagalak group. So, you know, the siren song of our First Nations people had been calling to me for many, many years. When I lived in Germany, I somehow had a vinyl. I'd found a vinyl in a record store of songs of Central Australia, and I played it to Günter Klutt, who I used to work with a lot, and said, you know, check this out. And we'd listen to it and go, oh, you know, what is it?
Yeah.
You was that it was really, really old.
Yeah.
And I just thought, I've got to find a way of understanding what this music is about. You know, and I met Tom Lewis and, you know, who used to sit in sometimes, played Yidaki, and he actually came from Beswick, which was near Nooka, but I only made that connection later.
Mm.
But, you know, you've got to be ready for these things.
Yes, yeah.
Like that. You've actually got to be in the, I think, you're mentally preparing for things before they happen.
Yes, yes.
So I had sort of mentally prepared in a way for the ABC, although I ended up, that ended up not being a particularly positive experience for me. But all of these collaborative things that I've done in music, I was kind of mentally prepared for them. I'd figured out a kind of way to go about it.
Yes.
And again, it's the people that you work with who will make it or break it. Either the people you're collaborating with want it or not.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I can't force it on anybody because a lot of these people, I'm way more senior and way more, have way more capacity to realize these ambitions than me.
Yeah, yeah.
And I've got to kind of, you know, figure out, well, all I can do is be a kind of somebody who, you know, a facilitator in a way.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes, I play a leadership role, but as much as anything else, it's using whatever chops I have to help to make things happen.
Yes.
Can't force people.
Yeah.
You can only do it if you're working with great people because then you're working with great material.
Absolutely.
Amazing material. You've got these incredible people and then you go, okay, let's put this together. It was the same with The Theft of Cedar when I was working with the Balinese musicians. Mm. You know, a whole team of extraordinary people, and that was a multimedia work.
Yes.
Bill Jamison, the director, and Wayan Ouija, and, you know, Udana, the great sort of, you know, radical Balinese gamelan musician, and, you know, all these really exceptional people. So it was no different with the Young Rugalak group, you know, masters of their trade, you know, they
yes.
are great ceremonial musicians of their communities.
It's an incredible model of engagement that you're talking about there. And as you say, you know, with that kind of assumed seniority that we have and that kind of, you know, I guess coming off from a privileged position into those environments and collaborating and, you know, the whole question. I know we have a lot of debate these days around appropriation and engaging with it in a meaningful way and making sure there's the agency of the voice of the artist. It takes a lot of judgment, I can imagine.
Which is appropriate. I mean, yep. You know, these are important things. And, you know, we have not dealt well with our First Nations on any kind of level. It doesn't matter which bit of it you want to talk about. None of it has been handled well. In fact, you know, on the scale from outright murder to dispossession to, you know, to the results of the referendum, I mean, it's not a great story we're telling here.
No.
Doesn't reflect well on any Australian, I don't think. But, you know, there are those of us who believe that the struggle continues and that will continue to be the case. And, you know, eventually what will be will be.
Yes. And I mean, there's so much I want to come back to some of those things, but I want to just talk about The Voice right now and from your position as, you know, a leading cultural figure in Australia and someone who was involved with absolutely campaigning for a yes vote. And I mentioned to you before I heard you talking with Marcia Langton very eloquently about, you know, how you saw the importance of this particular election. This referendum, and obviously it didn't go the way that many of us in our community were hoping. What do you think was the role of the arts in that particular conversation? Do you think the arts, we could have done more, we could have contributed more, or do you think it was just that the speed of the cultural conversation was acting at two different sort of speeds or two different tempos?
Yeah, well, it's a tricky one that, you know, a lot of people in the arts world got on board and were very clear about their preference. The great majority of them, of course, were yes inclined. But it was really interesting to see the pushback. You know, I mean, I think what we had underestimated was just the entrenched kind of view that, you know, what, yet again, we have to do something for these people. You know, we've given them the vote. What else do they want? And, you know, just the kind of very, very outrageous, I thought, results. You know, even if we had failed, I was kind of hoping it would be close, but it wasn't, you know, and I think that says a lot about the situation in general, but again, about the very limited capacity that artists have to, you know, change what is a kind of huge, monolith of feeling, which is really quite deep in this country and very easy then to turn into wedge politics.
Yes.
You know that there is a kind of a sort of a chance that half the population are going to vote against an initiative like that, then it's easy to manipulate that through misinformation, through scare campaigning, through, you know, particularly through finding Aboriginal people who are prepared to take the negative viewpoint and, you know, a combination of these things and really just sink the ship, bring it all undone.
Mm.
That's what happened here. So yeah. I don't think that the arts can do a whole lot about that. And look, if you really look at it in the cold, harsh light of day, I'm not sure that the arts have ever made a huge impact on Australian society.
Mm.
And maybe you could say that somebody like Barry Humphries did, in the way that, you know, he kind of shone a light on a particular kind of Australian suburban mentality. But, you know, the counter argument there is, well, yes, you could, but then you could also say it was misogyny and it was, you know, it only is talking to white Australian people about being white too, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm not, by the way, drawing any conclusions here, but I'm saying there aren't many people. I mean, how many people have read Patrick White?
Yeah.
You know, how many people read Christos Tsiolkos? I mean, how many people read Richard Franklin? They're all very important people. You know, Judith Wright, how many people read the poetry? You know, it might be taught in schools, but do people sit down and read it? I'm not sure. Maybe not.
And we see this exodus of people that, you know, Patrick White's and those that, you know, even back then were leaving the country and running away from cultural cream.
Yeah.
And this kind of thing.
I mean, how many people really look at, I mean, these are mainly the works of men that I'm talking about, so forgive me. But, you know, a Fred Williams painting. Well, let's talk about an Emily Kinguare. You know, how many people take time out to go and look at those things and contemplate them and allow that to become part of your DNA in the same way that, I guess, you know, the music of Bach and Beethoven, it's kind of in the DNA of Germans, Mozart and the Haydns in the DNA of the Austrians. Didn't stop them from not carrying out the Holocaust, mind you, but
no.
It's there, right? And, you know, French Impressionism or the art of the Rococo are kind of, you know, part of the French experience. We don't kind of have that so much.
It's interesting.
On the one hand, we're way too old.
Yeah.
And on the other hand, we're way too young. So we have this thing of the shock of the old when we're starting to look at the art of our Indigenous people. It's the shock of the old. We start to go, my God, that's amazing. That's incredible. That's so important. And it should be, you know, UNESCO World Heritage protected. And yet we tried to kind of kill off these people as, you know, that's the history that we're not prepared to own up to. And that expresses itself in a rejection of a referendum, which should be a no-brainer. So,
yeah. You've encapsulated the kind of the tragedy of the moment and the disappointment that we have around that, and just you know this evolving relationship that we have with culture, I think, as well. And an interesting thing too about is this idea of the arts and culture being involved in the wider social discourse. I thought it was very interesting last week. I don't know if you're aware of the Sydney Theatre Company, the controversy that they've been going through, but you've got politicians coming out and saying the arts have no place in, you know, and politics have no place in the arts and arts have no place in politics. And this is not the place for talking about political movements. And I personally couldn't disagree with that more. I think, you know, I think arts and society and social change are absolutely sort of in lockstep with each other. Do you share that view as well, Paul?
Well, I don't have a great deal of sympathy for what happened at the STC, I have to tell you. So I think that, again, this issue, which is, of course, such a burning issue at the moment, is also full of misinformation. And I don't want to get too much into that, but I hold a view.
Mm-hmm.
So let's just say that I have a view about that.
Sure, sure.
Do artists get involved in politics? Well, you know, I think it was Aristotle who said man is a political animal.
Mm.
So that's a very old idea. We are people who are involved in politics, because politics are the way that we organize ourselves, or it's a principle by which we organize ourselves. Therefore, people will have views about things, and some artists will be overtly political in the way that they just, you know, do their thing. If you want to know my actual thought, is that I think that art that sets out to be political self-consciously tends not to be very good art.
Mm.
Because I think that art needs in itself to be universal. It needs to have something which speaks to all people, needs to transcend the political divides and remind us of ultimately of our better selves, and hammering home some kind of ideological viewpoint via art. I don't reckon that the art necessarily is wonderful because it becomes too dependent on the message, and therefore it's got a use-by date.
Yeah. Yeah. It's very interesting, isn't it? This capacity of art to elevate societies and to take us to the, as you say, our better selves, this transformational capacity of art. But in a lot of times you'll see people say, oh, yes, but it's, you know, we sort of just put it in a box and protect it from actually intersecting with society. But when it can actually be a part of discourse and social change in a meaningful way, I think that's very powerful.
I mean, look, all I would say is that I guess if I really look into my own mind and think about the art that I have loved in my life, and that's made a huge impression on me, I don't think that politics has been a driver in the art that I'm thinking of.
So just going back to some of those big leadership roles that you've had, and you talked about stepping into the ABC and, you know, incredibly important cultural institution. Mm. And as you mentioned, the word bureaucracy, it was famously has been a, you know, complicated organization over the years. How did you find that experience of working in there? And did you find that you could actually influence the agenda and influence the kind of direction of the broadcaster?
I would say no. Definitely not. No, it was very fraught time for the ABC, but I mean, you know, you could ask the question, when does it not? Howard had come in and the ABC had received a massive cut in the funding. And then they did this weird thing where they kind of divided the organization in between its kind of commissioning arm and its production arm. And of course, the vast majority of the ABC is production and the commissioning is tiny. So it was a very asymmetrical kind of idea.
Yeah.
And it meant that the production apparatus had to vie for the right to make this or that program against the private sector. And meanwhile, a lot of very experienced ABC people took packages, went out into the private sector, and then you'd be hiring them back, you know, costing more money than it would have if they'd stayed in the organization. So I can't help but think that the rationale behind this was a very strange.
So neoliberalism, I think, isn't it? Something like that. Yeah.
It is absolutely that. And so I was never comfortable with it. And then, you know, I did feel that we would get interference. We used to have a show, which was a kind of arts magazine show, which was hosted by Stephen Fennelly.
Yes.
A man of very strong opinions, you know, and he would start the show with a kind of editorial to camera piece. And boy, we used to get some serious flack from the 8th floor about that stuff. So, yeah, I mean, after a while, I just thought, is this what I want to do with my life?
Yeah.
Always, you know, getting on a plane to Sydney, like sometimes twice a week. And, you know, my children were very young then. And, you know, I felt that I was somehow my soul was being eked out of me kind of bit by bit. And I wanted to go back to being just a creative person.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I had been working with the filmmaker Paul Cox, and Paul had just started to do this big project, a biopic about Father Damien of Molokai. And I really, you know, I really wanted to be in, you know, to have a bit of that. I mean, that's a whole other story too. But, you know, that pulled me definitely. And, you know, I just finally said to my bosses, I'm really sorry, but I can't do this anymore. And, you know, I think they might have been slightly relieved because I don't think I was the right person for the job, to be honest. You've really got to believe that that is where you're best placed, you know, that you, all of whatever skills you possess are best applied to that particular situation. And I didn't ever really think, I had a bit of imposter syndrome. I thought, well, I've got this job, but am I really the right person for it? And again, I had some brilliant people who I was working with, really fantastic people, particularly who worked in the popular music area. And, you know, I sowed the seeds for the program, which later became Long Way to the Top. And, you know, those, and then of course, I'm not taking credit for that because the people who make the programs should take the credit. I did what I did. And I'm sure other historians of the ABC would have a far more clear idea of what, if, you know, if any contribution I made to it. But I feel that in some of the other leadership roles that I had, like Queensland Music Festival, you know, the Adelaide festivals that I did, I can, you know, I'm far clearer.
Yeah.
Well, you know, that happened and I'm very proud of that. And
yes.
Needless to say, you know, the AAO, which is a different kind of leadership role. I'm extremely proud of that. And I'm very, very proud of the role that I've had at Monash University for now 11 years, you know.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah.
There's and just talk a little. A lot to point at.
Yeah. Like. Yeah. No, incredible. And like, I was just going to come to your role at Monash now because you are an educator, but you also have this sort of curatorial role with Monash Performing Arts Centre and you have this wonderful influence on the musical life of Monash. What have you been able to achieve at Monash and in that sort of academic environment? How have you found that, you know, as a cultural leader, as a performer, as an artist and an educator, how has that enabled those ambitions to come to fruition?
Well, the first thing to say is that I'm largely not an educator here. I've done some, but that's not my role. I was brought in by, at the time, the Vice Chancellor, Professor Ed Byrne, off the back of having been the AD of the Adelaide Festival. And Ed had a vision for the Monash Clayton campus as being what he described as a cultural hub for Southeast Melbourne. So, growing beyond its functionality as a campus and building on what already did exist, which was a community-based outreach that some of our cultural infrastructure had already at the time, which was 2012. Mm. So at that time we had Robert Blackwood Hall, which is a, you know, 1600 seat hall where the Melbourne Symphony Orchestra did a subscription series, and we had Alexander Theatre. And these were venues which both were sort of foundation buildings at Monash, which, after all, Monash is really from the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
And we had another outlier at the Peninsula campus here, the George Jenkins Theatre, which is like a 430-seater with a thrust stage. So, you know, for him to talk about it being a cultural hub, okay, well, that's good in principle. The kind of spearhead of this was going to be a building that he saw as being his legacy, which would have been designed by the Israeli architect Moshe Safdie, and it was going to be a new school of music building featuring a recital hall, which the Potter Foundation had put quite a few millions of dollars on the table for as a sort of down payment against this thing being built on the, you know, the understanding that, you know, of the funds to build the rest of it would be raised through whatever means.
Mm-hmm.
And that part of it didn't happen. It fell over. And that all took place just as I was, you know, brought in, firstly, as a Vice Chancellor's fellow, mm-hmm. working directly with the school. And around about that time, I got a phone call from Steve Vizard's brother, Andy, saying, "We hear you've just, you know, signed on to Monash University. The Vizard Foundation would be interested in, you know, tell us a project because we will fund it as long as the university matches us dollar for dollar." I mean, this was completely unsolicited out of the So that gave birth to the Monash Art Ensemble, which is a thing I founded at that time.
Incredible.
Students and professional musicians and faculty members together working shoulder to shoulder on new music involving improvisation and notation.
Mm. It's
definitely related to the AAO, but not the same.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And the idea about it was that we would, you know, commission new music, we would perform it, and we would record it. So
yeah.
Take everybody through that cycle. And, you know, again, that continues to this day. In fact, we're rehearsing tonight for something.
Yeah.
And then I got a phone call saying, from the vice chancellor, saying the director of the what was called Monash Academy of Performing Arts is resigning to take up another position. I want you to become the director of Monash Academy of Performing Arts. So I thought, okay, that sounds like a teaching gig, but it's not, you see. It's the organ of the university which oversees the infrastructure.
Yes.
Hires out the venues, basically funnels money from the vice chancellor's portfolio into the School of Music.
Yep.
Certain projects. And that was pretty much what it did. And ran the University Symphony Orchestra, the Monash Academy Orchestra.
Mm.
So I thought, okay, so how do I make this very tiny little organization into the vision splendid of the cultural hub for Southeast Melbourne with its catchment of 2.3 million people.
Mm.
So I said, you know, I started thinking about it, which is always a good place to start. And I thought, okay, well, American universities do this kind of thing.
Yeah.
Looked at UCLA, for example, had at that time UCLA Live. And that then became the Center for the Art of Performance, which Christy Edwards headed up. She had been the director of the Melbourne Festival, American woman who became the head of this thing. And it was, you know, like a high-end curatorial position. They had great venues and they had all these amazing touring organizations that would do shows there. It was like a rolling arts festival. That's what they did.
Mm, mm.
Stanford had a similar thing. And, you know, a lot of the regional US universities are effectively cultural hubs for their areas.
Yes.
You think about places like, you know, Champaign, Illinois, which is right in the middle of the sort of farm belt in Illinois. That's what they do, you know.
Mm.
And they really are very useful kind of, you know, conduits for all sorts of cultural activity.
Mm.
And they have a relationship to the university community as well. So that's the way I started to think. But what we didn't have was the kit, because the Alexander Theatre was falling down, literally.
Yeah.
And, you know, they were, if you looked at the future plans for the university, it wasn't even on there. So they had planned, obviously, to knock it over. And when this new School of Music building was clearly not going to happen, I said to Ed, has anybody considered repurposing the Alexander Theatre? Yes, okay, it's problematic. It's a fly tower theatre. I understand that, you know, turning that into a music venue is no easy matter.
Mm.
But at least can we look at it before you knock it over? So that happened, and we were presented with this opportunity to do something quite radical, which was to experiment with active acoustic systems. So, you know, that is applying a very, very sophisticated digital method of sampling and redirecting, shaping and redirecting sound so that you can have an incredible audience experience, but also great for the performers on stage. But, you know, it's not the same as acoustic.
And yeah.
People need to understand that it is that.
Yes, yes.
And, you know, we went around the world looking at different versions of the system, and the one that I fell in love with was, of course, the most expensive one, which is the Meyer Audio Constellation system. It's miraculous.
Yeah.
And so it was decided not only would we, you know, repurpose the Alexander Theatre, which meant kind of, and this, oh, by the way, the decision to go ahead with this happened after Ed had left.
Right.
Margaret Gardner became the vice chancellor, now the governor of Victoria.
Mm.
She, you know, really had this fantastic vision for going back to the original concept for the Clayton campus generally, which was a progressive university in an Australian bushland setting. So the idea of this seminal modernist building from 1968, if we could make something new and real and exciting out of that, straight into her vision for Monash. And that was the first Capital Works project that she greenlit.
Wow. Gosh.
So not only did we get that, but we built this entirely new a center, which now has three venues. It has the jazz club. We insisted on calling the Counts. So there you go. One to rest in the club. Yeah. And the David Lee Sound Gallery, which is, a room which really does show off the Maya Constellation system in all its glory. Room, which is a really fantastic room into anything that you want it to be from a sonic point of view. So that's the achievement. You know, I can say, under my watch, that did happen. We're now doing some staged renovations to Robert Blackwood Hall over 3 years, which will bring that kind of into the 21st century to a degree as well. And, you know, I've really had a good run here. I love the place.
Yeah.
And look, if I could be frank, I'm glad that I'm not in the academic world.
Yes. Yes. You know,
I've seen a lot of changes happen in the school during the course of my time here. Not all of them would have met with my approval necessarily. And I'm glad not to be part of the intra faculty politics, which necessarily are a part of academic life in any university.
Finally.
And because the school is part of the Faculty of Arts and not a separate faculty, you know, that's challenging from time to time because you need people who understand the value of it. And it's not always clear, I think, within the university. I mean, I'm sure that there are people at the university who don't even know there's a school of music there. It's not like Melbourne where they had the conservatorium. It's a separate thing. Now they've merged the conservatorium with the VCA in a beautiful new John Wardell building. And, you know, it's a great outcome, I'm sure, for everybody. My role is different. It far more suits everything that I've been telling you today about what I represent. For better or worse, you know, it is a true expression of all of those things.
It's a fantastic achievement, yeah.
Well, look, it is what it is. But, you know, through the Monash Art Ensemble, I still have a direct connection to the students. So, you know, I do feel like I'm not completely out of touch.
Yeah, no, that's amazing. I'm sure that you've influenced the careers of many students coming through that ensemble over the years, over that period of 11 years, and a wonderful body of recordings too that's come out of that as well.
They've encountered some amazing people. I mean, Carl, you know, worked with them, Steve Swallow, you know, the great Polish Tomasz Stanko, you know, Django Bates, really some heavy hitters doing some pretty amazing music. Dave Douglas is another one.
Incredible.
So, yeah, they've had some good experiences for sure.
George, that's wonderful. Thank you. Listen, Paul, you've been very generous with your time today, and we're coming to sort of the conclusion of our time together. But I just wanted to, I guess, you know, we've reflected on you know, your incredible extended career in arts in Australia, your perspective and involvement in so many different genres, so many different spaces. With a closing thought, just this, with this idea of cultural leadership, where would you like to see cultural leadership in Australia heading in the next, you know, we've just had this referendum. We've just had this kind of moment at, you know, what's the way forward and where would you like to see the cultural leadership aspect of where we're going in Australia?
It's a very big question you've put there. Look, there are things to bear in mind. I think the first thing to be aware of is that the younger generations who are coming up, who will be the future leaders, they are dealing with very different kinds of issues than my generation. You know, information technology and AI are going to be two very big things that are very related, of course, but are changing at warp speed. And where that all heads is anybody's guess. So they've got to really be able to have their hands on the sort of tiller about that. You know, figure out where the levers are and how to work them to the benefit of the greater good. That's part of it. And the other thing is that we've got to never lose sight of the fact that we in this country are the inheritors of the world's oldest artistic traditions. That should be what informs our ultimate view about where the arts sit in society. In traditional Indigenous practice, there was no sort of idea that, well, I'm an artist and I only make art. Art was part of the life experience of everybody. It was part of their way of transmitting knowledge, of telling stories, and of celebrating important moments in their lives, births, deaths, other, you know, things that would happen to men and women, and, you know, often differently for men and women, or we would now say different genders would have different kinds of needs, you know. So, I mean, this complete integration into the fabric of society, the more that we can help to make those things possible, to bring everybody into the sense that there is a creative person within, and all that needs is for the leadership to allow for that energy to be tapped into, in order that, as I said earlier, we can release our better selves, our better selves. That won't necessarily mean our ideological selves, but I bet that, you know, if we have the empathy, which being an artist should be able to teach you, then that in turn will influence the way that we are able to call ourselves political people.
It's a fantastic way to frame it, Paul. I love this idea of self-actualization becoming, you know, that the connection with everything, society, and you know, getting in touch with, as you say, your better self. I think that's an incredible way to frame cultural leadership. Thank you for your time today. Thank you for your immense contribution to Australian cultural life, for being a fantastic cultural leader, for continuing to influence generations and generations of artists and musicians, along, you know, all different genres and all different spaces. It's been a privilege and a pleasure to talk to you today. Thank you so much. Thank you very much for your time.
Lovely fella. So thank you very much for those very kind words. I'm not sure I'm totally deserving of them.
Thank you for joining me on this edition of Decoding Cultural Leadership. Hope you enjoyed today's episode. If you did, please consider subscribing via your preferred platform so you never miss an episode. You can even write us a review. You can follow us on Instagram, X, and Threads at DCLPod. That's at DCLPod. You can also write to me at sc@samuelcandough.com. My huge thanks to creative director Niloufar Pashfarouche. And thanks to our production partners, Limelight, Australia's dedicated music, arts and culture platform. Please head over to their website, limelight-arts.com.au, to read content related to this podcast. Decoding Cultural Leadership is recorded on the Wurundjeri, Gadigal and Palawan lands. And I acknowledge elders past and present, and the immense privilege of hosting this conversation on lands where cultural leadership has been practiced for millennia before us. My name is Sam Candough. This is a production of the Institute of Cultural Leadership, and we'll see you next time on Decoding Cultural Leadership.